This is Regionally Speaking, Reporters Roundtable Thursday on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte, and let's turn now to Meredith Kolias-Pete, who's a reporter for the Post Tribune about the stories that she's put out there in print and online recently. Meredith, thanks for joining us on the program today.
Hey, Chris.
Let's first talk about one story you put out there in working through the paperwork about the state audit that gives us an idea how bad off, financially at least, the city of Gary really is.
The State Board of Accounts just recently released an audit on City of Gary finances. The city's obviously been known for, running in the red for quite a long time. What it's noticing currently is that its general fund, which to you and me would be like the checking account, like as a family that you use to pay bills, its general account is about $7 million in the red.
What more did the auditors happen to determine and you had a chance to look at in the paperwork that kind of gives people an idea of how Gary was seeming to kind of borrowing from Peter to pay Paul, so to speak?
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of been the story over there at City Hall for quite a long time. It kind of just gives a picture on, what Gary does to try to stay afloat from day to day, basically. Things like taking property, taking his anticipated property tax receipts early and sort of figuring that into the budget, but mm-hmm. also, transferring money from account to account to sort of, try to make sure that the city can function on a daily basis, basically.
I know you mentioned that the auditors happened to gig the Gary Sanitary District in particular. They had a pretty deep deficit in picking up trash in the city of Gary. I wonder if that was because either, A, there was so much trash to pick up, or, B, there was so much extra work because not all the neighborhoods are, packed with houses. They had to drive those trash trucks around a lot to be able to get stuff picked up.
And that's a great point. I'm not entirely sure at that point, but officially the auditors kind of go in and they, try to see that the city is crossing the T's and dotting the I's, basically. But in Gary for some time that's just not happening. A lot of it just comes down to the fact that, like you mentioned, the city has quite a few abandoned houses. They really struggle to collect property taxes.
Yeah.
That's kind of the story over there, basically, is that, the auditors say that they're running the deficit in trash collection, which basically just means that the city is not taking in enough money to cover how much it costs to collect trash.
Yeah. Do you get the impression that the Freeman-Wilson administration is trying to keep all the individual departments aware of what the audit results had so they can kind of be aware, if they're not already, be aware of the deficits and try to cut back even more?
Yeah, there's no question. This is kind of a standard report that is done by state auditors. Part of the process is that they go in and they meet with the mayor and they meet with the heads of like a relevant department once they kind of check over their books and they're, briefing them on this. So they're well aware of it. And it does say in the audits, particularly with the sanitary district, is that they've promised the state that they will look at ways to try to cut costs.
Okay. Now, I know, Meredith, another story that you put out there in print and online kind of brings us up to date with a topic that we haven't covered much lately anyway, and that's the USS-led Superfund site in East Chicago. The neighborhoods have been affected by the industrial activity over the decades, many decades, and the impact on all that, too. The EPA has gotten into the fray, I guess, lately now with a federal court lawsuit. Tell us about that, and tell us about how the soil samples that they're requesting might work out if they get the permission for it.
Yeah, up in East Chicago, of course, there is a Superfund site, former USS-led lead smelter. The EPA basically just filed some documents recently in federal court. There is maybe about 8 houses in Zone 2 there that are basically abandoned, and they want to test it, and they can't without permission from the owners. So they found maybe about 8 properties. They only located one owner. It's in Zone 2, so if you're familiar with East Chicago, they're basically on Alexander and McCook and Vernon, which is kind of in between Goodman Park and Riley Park, if you're familiar with the area.
Mm-hmm.
Basically they just went to court and said, hey, we want to test you know, we want to test these properties. If an owner happens to come forward, you know, you have like a 5 days or something to protest if you don't want them to do it. They've kind of been up there in zone two since about 2016. So I think that this is kind of, you know, just kind of a couple of properties that they haven't been able to get to test for lead and arsenic. Of course, in court documents, they have to file their justification for that. But, you know, anyone familiar with that area knows that, 85% in particular in zone two of the properties that they've tested, have really shown high levels of lead and arsenic in the soil. The EPA for some time has been remediating yards and homes and things like that. And so they anticipate, potentially with these couple properties that, you know, showing industrial contamination there too.
Now, you mentioned in your story and in print online too, that the fact that it's been difficult to try to reach some of the property owners or residents, I guess, and probably in some cases, or maybe former residents, maybe I probably should say, in those areas because of the situation. I mean, they've had to move out or they've moved out already, and they probably would like to get more samples from land, but they're probably not going to get all that they want, huh?
Yeah, I mean, it happens in towns. These properties are abandoned, like I mentioned. They just can't find who lives there. Mm-hmm. Whether or not people moved out in recent years or it's been abandoned for some time, you know, I'm not quite sure. But one thing I want to, for folks listening, just kind of throw out there, the EPA is going to hold a community meeting tonight at the former Carrie Gosch School. They sort of go there and set up stations, and they have folks just, have residents come in, and there's folks from the EPA and engineers and whatnot, and they just kind of like explain the process. So sort of like a one-on-one kind of deal.
Yeah.
They kind of explain the process that's going on. There's two times if people are interested that they could go like 3 to 5 p.m. today or 6 to 8 if people are interested.
That's great. Nice to know that and to be aware that there are some opportunities for citizens up there in East Chicago that might be affected by all this or have property up there that's affected by all this lead and arsenic contamination. They should show up to the meetings and get their questions answered and say what they need to say to be sure. I know one of the other stories too that I wanted to ask about. In fact, it's just in the Post Tribune today. Is an update on the baby boxes, and we have now more of them established around Northwest Indiana. Tell us the latest on the baby box there.
Yeah, St. Catharines in East Chicago just added a baby box yesterday, so they kind of had a little like unveiling of it. I think it's about the fifth one. So,
yeah.
You know, basically if someone has an infant, you know, like a woman's given birth to an infant, you know, and it's pretty clear that, you know, they can't raise it. It's just, you know, kind of there's going through some difficulties in life. You can drop off the baby. Usually these are in like hospitals or fire stations. No questions asked, no chance of prosecution. The baby gets dropped off safe and, you know, then kind of gets taken care of and later put up for adoption. It's kind of that kind of deal. So this is the first one at community. Franciscan has a couple, I believe, like a Chesterton, and I believe, if I'm not mistaken, it's in like a fire station. The folks over at St. Catharines, have really said that, that this is something that they want to make available for the community. Mary Pentello, who is a longtime neonatal nurse over at Community, I mean, she's kind of been there decades and is a big advocate for, sudden death syndrome awareness and, trying to make a dent in, Indiana's, particularly the region's, very, very high levels of infant mortality, has said that this is a beacon of light for folks that, if you're down on your luck, this is kind of the place that, you can leave a baby and make sure that they'll be well taken care of. Leave the baby, like a silent alarm gets tripped, and then, they know the child is there.
Yeah.
So I know that Methodist and Gary said that they have plans to add one in January as well. So,
I wonder if we're going to find that over time that we're going to see more and more babies dropped off. It seems that you're getting closer and closer to the state line, so there may be mothers in Illinois that can't be able to take care of their babies, and they may feel that's the only option they may have is to leave it and have someone take care of it.
Yeah, and that was a part of the thinking, too, is that I know, like, in Michigan City was mentioned, there's a couple beeboxes out there that, you know, they try to strategically place these, like, off highways and stuff so that it's really accessible for folks if they happen to need it. So, in total, this kind of nonprofit named Safe Haven Baby Box, I guess that they have, like, 17 or so of these baby boxes now in three states. The founder who was there yesterday said to date, I guess since 2016, like 59 babies have been dropped off. So it looks like it's being, you know, used for sure. In the region, it looks like, you know, three have been dropped off so far, like two in Michigan City, and I believe one just last month in Hammond.
That's right. That's right. Well, that means the more boxes, the more opportunities that are out there, to be sure. Well, Meredith, thank you for talking about the stories that you had online in print there in the Post Tribune, and we hope to have you back on soon.
Thank you.
Meredith Collius-Pete is a reporter for the Post Tribune. Susan Shumsky is the author of Maharishi and Me, Seeking Enlightenment with the Beatles Guru. And she spent 22 years in the ashrams of Maharishi Mahesh Yogi. And Susan has written 17 books and spent more than five decades teaching thousands of people meditation, prayer, affirmation, and intuition. And in this conversation, Shumsky talks about how Maharishi had influenced the music of the Beatles. The conversation with Lakeshore Public Radio, Sharon Jackson.
Tell us a little bit about yourself and the real story behind Hinduism's impact on the Beatles. If someone were to ask, you know, why are you a person who would know about that, what would you tell them?
Well, I spent 22 years in the ashrams of Maharishi Mahesh Yogi and 6 years on his personal staff. And he was the Beatles guru. So I had firsthand experience of what it was like to live with this spiritual master who was probably the most famous guru of the 20th century.
Going back to the Beatles for a minute, what was the meaning of the songs Revolution and Blackbird?
Well, Revolution was a song that obviously, if you listen to the lyrics, it's about the revolution of the 1960s and all of that and the anti-war movement. But it's much more than that because it's about something called the Maharishi effect. Maharishi always said that in order for the forest to be green, the trees must be green. In order for the world to be at peace, all the individuals in the world must be at peace. So his philosophy, his actual mission, his mission statement, and is the thing that he focused on his entire life was to create world peace by getting as many people as possible to meditate. And I think is a very valid philosophy because how are you going to have a peaceful world if you don't have peaceful people? So what he would do, in fact, he would send hundreds of people to crime-ridden areas and to war-torn areas, and then he would have his scientists go there and track what was going on in the area to see that the war was subsiding, that the crime rate was going down. And they measured the war, amazingly, by hospital admissions. So they did all these studies and they discovered that, in fact, meditation did create waves of peace and that it did change the atmosphere very, very quickly and the wars and the crimes would go down. So it was this Maharishi effect is what John Lennon was talking about when he was talking about you got to change your mind instead. Maharishi always said that you'll never create world peace through treaties, through negotiations, and certainly not through war, but you can create it by having peaceful people. So that's what John was talking about, change your mind instead in Revolution.
What about in Blackbird?
Now, Blackbird, so when that song came out, Paul McCartney at first, he said he was inspired by a blackbird that he heard early in the morning in Rishikesh. Well, I was in Rishikesh. I was there for 6 months the first time I went there, and I was with Maharishi at the ashram. And yeah, there were blackbirds. They were crows, and they were screeching. It didn't sound anything like the Tweety birds that are in that song, Blackbird. But in the song, they are actually blackbirds. But then, decades later, Paul changed his story about the song. He said that it was about black, meaning African-American, birds, meaning women, which is what they called females in the 1960s in England. So Blackbird, okay, it's really, it's my favorite song on the album. It's an incredibly inspiring song. And I think it's about anyone who has a broken wing and needs healing. So it's a very healing song, and it gives me chills every time I hear it.
So it's about African Americans being liberated, right?
Yes, that's the idea. African Americans, female, specifically Blackbird, being liberated. In fact, yes. Okay. That's what he said later. I mean,
I don't think
that was his original intention with the song. He wanted to create more gravitas. He wanted to attribute more profundity to the song. So that's what he did.
Is that why he changed the story?
I believe. I mean, that's just my theory.
Oh, okay.
Why else would he change the story, you know?
Right. Yeah. So how did you end up working for the Maharishi?
You know, I was so impressed with my experience of transcendental meditation that I immediately wanted to teach it. So I started applying for the teacher training courses. I was only 19 years old, and you had to be 24 and be a college graduate. So they kept rejecting me. I applied for the course that the Beatles went on. I did not know the Beatles would be there, but I applied, and I applied to 3 different courses. Finally, you know, fourth time's a charm. I was able to go to Rishikesh and study with Maharishi, became completely enamored with his energy and with his teachings and everything about him. And I wanted so much to study with him and became a teacher. And I was teaching transcendental meditation, was going to advanced courses. And I noticed that there was this thing called international staff. And the people on international staff were very close to Maharishi. So, of course, I wanted to do that. So I just went up to him and I said, Maharishi, I want to join your international staff. And he said, what you will do? And I said, I will do anything. And he said, okay, come. Which is what he always used to say. And by the way, there's a song about that. It's called Everyone's Got Something to Hide Except Me and My Monkey. And that song is entirely consisting of expressions that Maharishi used to say. Come on. Anytime he'd want you to come visit him in his room or talk to him privately, he'd say, come on, or come. And then he would always say, it's such a joy, it's such a joy. And his third most favorite expression was, take it easy, take it as it comes. So John Lennon wrote that song, and it's completely Maharishi's words. And then because John Lennon was in such a huff about Maharishi, he never, ever admitted that that's what that song was. However, George Harrison did. He said that those were all expressions from Maharishi. I think that Maharishi really influenced the Beatles, but Maharishi had a tremendous influence on the entire culture, on the entire society, and the entire world through turning people on to meditation, which now has become more popular than ever. There's approximately somewhere between 10 and 14%, depending on who you read, of people claim that they meditate in the United States. So, wow, that certainly wasn't true in 1959 when Maharishi first came to America.
Do you think that Maharishi was such an influence through the Beatles? I mean, since the Beatles were such a cultural phenomenon and he got affiliated with them, do you think some of his reach is due to them?
Absolutely. I mean, the Beatles are the ones that put Maharishi on the map and made him really popular. However, after John and George left Rishikesh in a huff, Maharishi became even more famous and more popular. He became incredibly famous. He was on The Tonight Show quite often. He was on Merv Griffin's show. He was on the cover of every major magazine, Life, Look, Time, Saturday Evening Post, Newsweek. He was everywhere. So he was really became very, very famous, partly due to the Beatles, but then really everybody started meditation. They were lined up around the blocks, queued up to learn TM, literally. And that happened in the 70s.
That's author Susan Shumsky talking about how the Maharishi Mahesh Yogi influenced the music of the Beatles. You can hear the entire conversation on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org. Continuing on with Regionally Speaking's Reporter Roundtable Thursday. On this Thursday, let's turn to Joe Pete, who is the business editor and writer for the Times of Northwest Indiana. Hi, Joe. Thanks for joining us on the show today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Well, a lot here about U.S. Steel. A couple major stories to pass along here. Let's talk about the idea of some restructuring that has obviously been in the works with U.S. Steel for some time. We're finally seeing some changes at the top because of it. Tell us about the changes.
Yes, there's been a flurry of news lately about U.S. Steel ever since they announced that they were expecting a much worse than anticipated third quarter financially. They've been struggling a lot as of late and are trying to take a lot of action to move the needle. Well, one of their big problems is their stock has sunk into about $10 a share. Their market capitalization is down to $1.9 billion. In last February, before the Section 232 tariffs were imposed, it was $8 billion. So they have lost more than 75% of their market capitalization in just a year, which is a pretty staggering figure. And they've just kind of been floundering with these low steel prices. A lot of investors were really hoping that the tariffs would be the answer. They had a good short-term effect, but in the long term, market conditions have again proved to be somewhat challenging. Now you're starting to see a bit of, like, an exodus and a restructuring. The CFO, Kevin Bradley, he's stepping down. They had another departure, another executive. She was leaving. Sarah Greenstein was leaving to become CEO of another publicly traded company, but they had two executives recently stepping down, and they're also restructuring their overall corporate management and saying they're going to look to cut $200 million a year, which frankly might not be very good news because we don't know yet how they're going to get that through employment or if that's going to affect any local facilities. They've been very vague and not going into any detail on how they're looking to cut that money. But they are looking to kind of streamline the company, and they put in this new executive structure in place where they have they reorganized basically who's in charge of what, and Scott Buckaso will now be in charge of chief manufacturing officer of the North American flat rolled segment, which includes our mills here at Gary Works and Gary Works in the Midwest plant in Portage, mm-hmm. and sort of East Chicago Tin, but it's going to be indefinitely idled in November, so we don't know its future or what's going on with that, unfortunately.
Yeah, with the separate story about that, we'll get to that in a little bit here, but you mentioned, too, about the changes that U.S. Steel was making because they took on another company, this Big River Steel, and is that good? Do you think it's going to help the company get maybe on a little more sound financial footing if they do make the changes that they were talking about?
Yes, because U.S. Steel has kind of been in a problem with Wall Street. It seems like they can't do anything right. They were basically, or anything that will please Wall Street, because they were basically, they were being chastised for not investing in their equipment and letting it kind of, get decrepit or whatever during the former Carnegie Way initiative, and they weren't spending enough to keep everything efficient, and their stock was depressed because of that. Then when market conditions started to turn, they were criticized for continuing to spend and sticking to their plan to do, various asset revitalization projects, like at the $750 million investment that's now underway at Gary Works, and then they're penalized by Wall Street for that. It just seems no matter what action they take, their stock price only goes down. But their latest gambit is to diversify more into mini mills. Obviously, here in the Lakeshore, we've had the huge integrated steel mills where they make basically new steel. They forge it from iron ore, from limestone, from raw materials. But that used to be the way most of the steel was made in the world. Over the past couple decades, you've seen the rise of the mini mills, where it's these lower cost, much smaller electric arc furnace operations where they basically take scrap metal and they recycle it into steel. Mm-hmm. And those have kind of, like, Nucor is now the largest steel maker in the United States. They're a mini mill operation. It's the mini mill companies that seem to be investing and doing well. They have a lower cost structure. The whole industry has been going that way. U.S. Steel is now looking to diversify into that. They're already planning to build an electric arc furnace in Alabama, a project that had been delayed when the market turned, but that they had recently revived. But now they are buying basically the newest steel mill in the United States, Northeast Arkansas, which is another steelmaking area, not as big as Northwest Indiana, but it's kind of in that vein where it's a hub of mini mills. And they are, this is a $3.2 billion facility. The company, Big River Steel, bills itself as like a technology company that happens to make steel, which is probably just, you know, marketing for investors. But they, you know, it's the state-of-the-art facility. And U.S. Steel is trying to diversify its production and kind of it's saying that it's going to be kind of three-pronged going forward. You know, the Gary Works, it's Mon Valley operations, and Gary Works is Mon Valley operations, and this new Big River Steel Mill, which would help them serve a lot of customers in the south in Mexico, where a lot of the automaking has been shifting, and where there's a lot of other business too. Like they have a big tubular pipe business. They sell a lot of pipe to Texas, and this would strategically position them to kind of better serve some of those markets.
Mm-hmm. Now, getting back to the East Chicago 10 division issue, you had an extensive story about that. Bring us up to date here. We know that a lot of this problem with I guess the cutback in tin, a tin coated metal, I should say, comes to the fact that we're using more plastics, which probably hasn't been good because we don't know what kind of plastics, and we can't really recycle them very well. Instead of cans, which you can always recycle, and number two, that we're finding that this just how consumers seem to be going these days to fresh foods. But that means that there's going to be less tin plated steel out there, and that's I guess why we're seeing plants like East Chicago Tin take it on the chin, literally, huh?
Oh, absolutely, yes. Yeah, the tin market has been declining for years. They do tin-plated steels for other things like paint cans and things of that nature, but the big business was always tin cans. And, you know, just consumers, especially younger consumers, are, you know, much prefer fresh foods versus, you know, canned foods. And, you know, with the soup market especially, like you've seen all the, you know, plastic packaging, which is, you know, will last forever. And steel is the most recycled material on earth. So steel is definitely better for the environment as far as that goes. But the problem is people go to work and they want to microwave some tomato bisque or whatever. And that, you know, they're going to want a microwave safe container so that they can, just heat it up like really quickly. And that market's been like slowly and steadily declining. But I think it was like Hemingway who said that like you go broke very slowly and then suddenly all at once. And that's basically what happened with the tin market. You saw it kind of implode this year. Del Monte announced they're going to close two of their major canning plants. And then within the same week, you saw ArcelorMittal respond by announcing major layoffs at its tin facility in West Virginia, and then U.S. Steel announced it would outright idle East Chicago Tin for an indefinite period and consolidate its tin-making operations to the Midwest plant in Portage and to U.S. Steel Gary, or to Gary Works in Gary. And it's saying that it's not permanent, but it's indefinitely idling the facility. They announced today that there are even more job losses than they initially had projected. They were initially saying it would be around 307 jobs that would be lost. And now they're saying it's up to 314 that'll also involve, you know, some security personnel and some a labor representative. I'm not sure how well that bodes, because usually when plants are idled, you typically will, you know, continue to have security and continue to have like maybe a skeleton crew just kind of taking care of the property and everything. So, but they're saying they have no idea when it's going to reopen, and if it will, and that'll depend on market conditions. But the big layoffs commence in November, and then the security and the additional layoffs will commence in December, and it'll continue through January of next year. So it kind of it's up in the air what's going to happen with that plant.
Well, just going to have to wait and see. It's certainly not going to be a very good Christmas, unfortunately, for some U.S. steel workers that work in East Chicago, to be sure.
Yes. Yeah. And also, sorry, I forgot to mention one point, too, because they're trying to, while the jobs will be lost, and that's not good, especially for the long-term state of the industry locally, they are going to try to transfer about half of those workers to the other mills. So they're anticipating the amount of people who will be laid off and out of work will be around 150, and that they'll be able to find places at their other mills in Northwest Indiana for the remaining workers. However, you don't want to see the general number. Obviously, for the 150 people, it's terrible, especially right before Christmas. And then the issue is, like, you have fewer jobs and job opportunities, you know, going forward in the future if the plant doesn't reopen. And it was idled in 2015 and then did reopen. However, you know, it's been kind of going one way with the tin can business. And, you know, when they went from, like, 400 employees to around 300 after the last idling. So it's never good when, you know, our facilities are shut down like this.
Now, I know
people's jobs and livelihood and you know, people are trying to feed their families.
Yeah. I know that, that we've talked about this before, too, that when it turned out that the Lear plant on 165th Street in Hammond was closing, and then going into the new facility, which is up there just right across the street, literally, from the South Shore Line train station, the East Chicago train station, that probably a lot of people were thinking, well, it won't be long before some other company moves in. And that's in turn what happened when Midland Metal Products decided to move over from Chicago to Hammond. And they had a big ceremony about that the other day, didn't they?
Oh, absolutely. Yes, you kind of have a industrial corridor there at 165th Street. You got Jupiter Aluminum and a bunch of other like large industrial companies, some steel contractors and things of that nature, business park. But the it ended up not sitting very long. Midland Metals products from Bridgeport in Chicago. They were in the city for 98 years. They're founded by like a Czechoslovakian immigrant, and they made a number of things over the years, including, you know, goalie masks, baseball umpire masks, and cigarette cases for retail stores. Now they're pretty much focusing on point of sale. They use American-made steel to kind of make those point of sale retail displays. You see, like when you're waiting near the checkout line in a Target or whatever, and they have the case with all the gift cards. Yeah. That's what they're making. And they took over the former Lear space. They've invested $7 million to move all their equipment in there and kind of rehabilitate the property. They've already added 15,000 square feet. They've added a printing operation. They're trying to become more vertical and kind of print a lot of the cards themselves for like cell phone plans and things of that nature to kind of be a one-stop shop for a lot of their retail clients. And they put in a new powder coating facility, but it's a pretty significant employer. It's 135, you know, good paying manufacturing jobs. They said they're currently hiring and that they're pretty much, you know, always looking for new talent. But they, you know, they came in, they took the property off the market and didn't let it sit vacant, which is, you know what you want. You want to be able to have jobs and employment and generating tax revenue and economic activity and everything.
Now, I know in your story you mentioned some quotes from the CEO of Midland Metal Products, Suzanne McDonald, and you mentioned in the interview, nobody in my family looked back at Chicago, and I imagine probably, I mean, just maybe being a little snarky here, that since they're moving out of the Bridgeport neighborhood into Hammond, that probably they don't want to look back because somebody might see the ghost of old man boss Richard Daley. That was his neighborhood. That's where he almost grew up in. That's where he lived in. So, you know, he probably is not happy, the ghost that is, was not happy to hear that another company has left Chicago and come to Indiana.
Oh, absolutely. They originally started downtown, I think, went back in nearly a century ago. Yeah. But they've moved a couple times over the years, but that's where they've long been based. But they said they pretty much needed to move because obviously, like with the Illinois, like we have seen the exodus a little bit, but it tends to be manufacturing companies and warehousing companies. And the reason why it's that and not like, you know, law firms or tech companies or whatever is because a lot of these companies have to be very, manufacturers especially have to be very competitive on price. And they are competing with China. They're competing with, you know, Taiwan, Vietnam. There are a lot of low-cost Mexico. There are a lot of other countries that have gotten into manufacturing that do it at a very low cost. They don't pay their workers there the same wages we do here. They don't have the same environmental regulations. There are all kinds of ways that they're able to cut, you know, costs. So in order to stay competitive, a lot of the manufacturing operations are trying to, you know, be as efficient as possible and kind of manage their costs as much as possible. And that's what Midland Metal said they the reason why they decided to move this time, because they were saying with there are higher taxes over there and also with uncertainty over what they'd be paying in the future, they just needed to be able to deliver low price points to their customers because they're in a bit of a challenged position too, because, you know, they're currently mainly serving the retail industry, the brick and mortar retail industry. And as we all know, that's been, you know, declining for a while. You drive anywhere in the country, you're going to see empty big box stores, empty stores in malls, empty stores in strip malls. It's just been challenging. So many people are just getting, you know, buying stuff and getting it shipped to their home via Amazon or, you know, Zappos or other e-commerce retailers. So they know that, and they've been looking at alternative markets that they can make products for. They say they have a good operation. They have good workers. They're looking to stay in business, and they're not averse to change. They'll suit whatever markets will have them, and they have been exploring potentially making metal fabricated products for automakers or, you know, potentially they're looking into what other markets they can potentially serve.
Now, Joe, we have a couple, 3 minutes left here for our conversation today, and I want to be sure to get in a look at the other story that we have that we want to take a look at in more particular. You had the story recently about the innovations that Strack and Van Til Supermarkets has been making, in particular at their St. John store there on US 41. It was an interesting story because people probably don't realize what kind of things that a retailer will do to try to attract not only new business, but to keep those longtime customers, right?
Oh, absolutely, yes. Strack and Van Til, largest region-based grocery chain, they have consistently, at least over the past several years, been really looking to, you know, keep up with the trends and keep up with what, you know, the latest and greatest. And they have, they did a big wave of renovations a couple years ago. They're doing it again. They just renovated their Crown Point store, and now there's St. John one. There's a grand opening at 8 a.m. next Wednesday, the 23rd. But they've added a lot of new features to it, a pineapple coring machine, which they think is the first in the area. They have a whole section for people on the keto diet. They've expanded a lot of the plant-based protein selections. They have a lot of meatless alternatives like Beyond Burgers and things of that nature. They've expanded the produce section by 10%, the value section by over 50%. They are stocking more natural and organic foods, prepackaged meals, because a lot of consumers these days are harried and just looking for something they can take home and heat up for the family very quickly. So they're kind of they're staying on top of best practices in the grocery industry and trying to provide people with what they're buying. They've expanded their craft beer selection to include more local beers, and they've expanded their national section to include more more items, especially European, Italian, and Hispanic items. And they are, you know, just looking to stay on top of what consumers are buying and, you know, wanting.
Are they getting a lot of these ideas, not only just seeing what the general overall trend seems to be with the supermarket business around the country, but are they getting maybe more suggestions locally from customers that say, hey, I heard about this, or maybe they've gone to Whole Foods and they've seen something like that there that maybe they thought that Strack and Van Til ought to put in?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, they base a lot of it on the customer feedback and what they're hearing from customers. But I know they're also very they're very on top of everything. Like, they follow the trade publications, they follow the, you know, trade shows, that type of thing. They're in tune with what's going on in the grocery business, you know, nationally. I think they actually just got an award for beef too from some national association. Wow. I did that story a couple weeks ago. But they you know they're constantly evolving their product mix. And it varies from store to store, too, because they have different purchasing people. But they've also made a push, too, in recent years to stock more locally produced products. Like, there is the Small Town Coffee they carry that's locally roasted. The Valparaiso stores are about to stock Paradise Icing, which is a new vegan pea protein-based icing that's made locally. And they've been turning a lot to more local producers because, you know, that's one thing people have been gravitating to, especially younger consumers. And they've been trying to, you know, just keep up with, keep up with that.
Well, that's the only way to stay alive. And I know in our conversations in the past with Jeff Strack, he says, you know, staying on top because the profit margin is just like with the restaurant industry. It's so almost razor thin. You've got to do something to be able to keep the customers coming in and keep them happy. And that's one way, obviously, that Strack and Van Til is doing it, to be sure. Well, Joe, thank you for spending time with us to talk about these stories that you have out there in print and online in the Times, and hope to have you back on again real soon.
Oh, thank you very much, and thank you so much for having me.
Oh, you're welcome. Joseph Pete is the business reporter and writer for The Times, and you're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Two longtime Indiana environmental groups have merged, and they've drafted some plans for a refocused mission on children's environmental and health initiatives. We're talking about the merger of the Hoosier Environmental Council with Improving Kids' Environment. And to find out more, let's check with Jesse Carbonza, who is the executive director and now of the merged organizations, but he is definitely the executive director of the Hoosier Environmental Council. And with us, we have Dr. Indra Frank, who is the HEC's environmental health specialist. She is, of course, in her job working there as well as with HEC as the environmental health director. And both of you, thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
Glad to be with you. Chris?
Yeah, good to be here, Chris. Thanks.
Jesse, I'll let you start off and let us know a little bit about the history, I guess, of both organizations. We know pretty much about the Hoosier Environmental Council, but about improving kids' environment. Tell us a little bit about the organization and the 20 years plus that it's been around and the interest in being able to be able to merge both organizations together.
Improving Kids' Environment was founded 20 years ago, and its aim was to figure out how to reduce risks, toxic risks to kids, whether it was in the context of homes, schools, or the community at large. And from my vantage point, one of the benefits of bringing these two organizations together is that it increases our legislative capacity to help improve children's health. Mm-hmm. In particular, one of the things that I've come to learn is that this merger will lead to about a 25% increase in our email contact base, and that allows us to have even greater capacity to try to galvanize the public to address a number of pieces of legislation that have bearing on children's health.
I would imagine that also gives you the opportunity with the base to be expanded to include not only health professionals, but educators and families as well, too, if I'm not mistaken.
Exactly. And those are constituencies that while we have relationships with over our 36-year history, this no doubt enhances it, given that Ike held conferences year after year, which brought in folks who were running schools, who were running daycare centers, public health professionals, and so forth. So those are constituencies that may or may not have been aware of legislation that has bearing on children's health, like funding for IDEM, like funding for the Indiana State Department of Health and county health departments, which certainly the more funding we have, that means we have more inspectors, that means we have the ability to retain quality permit riders, and ultimately those things benefit public health. So from my vantage point, and I know that Indra will speak to the very specific initiatives that we'll be taking on, proactive initiatives, but I really want to emphasize the importance of it expanding our legislative capacity.
Before we look at the initiatives here, Dr. Frank, tell us if you've had an opportunity with your tenure with the HEC as the Environmental Health Director, if you had some contact to improving children's environments, and what kind of work that you've been able to do either alongside them or with them, I guess, in many respects.
Well, good question, Chris. I'm a physician specialized in environmental health, and in the 15 years that I've been practicing environmental health, I've spent a good portion of that with Improving Kids' Environment. I served on their board of directors for a total of 9 years before I even became affiliated with the Hoosier Environmental Council. I've come to the conclusion that, you know, every environmental problem has human health consequences, and our children are often the most vulnerable when it comes to environmental problems impacting their health. Pound for pound, children breathe more air, drink more water, and eat more food than adults do, and so if there are harmful exposures in those media, they wind up with a disproportionate amount, and then they're also more susceptible because their bodies are still growing and developing, and those developing systems may not be mature enough to handle a harmful exposure.
Will you tell us about the different children's health initiatives that the Hoosier Environmental Council now with Improving Kids' Environment in this merger will be able to accomplish, or maybe some new initiatives that you'd like to establish?
Oh, absolutely. So all of the work that Hoosier Environmental Council has been doing benefits the children of Indiana, but this gives us an opportunity to really intentionally focus on the things that are particularly harmful to children. We have three initiatives that we're launching with this merger. One is to provide an information resource on children's environmental health. Improving Kids' Environment built a very helpful website that serves families and educators and healthcare professionals on children's environmental health issues. We're going to maintain and build on that website so that there's a really good information hub. And then second, we're going to continue Ike's work to reduce lead poisonings in Indiana. More than 1,000 children each year have elevated blood lead levels in Indiana, and that could put both their intelligence and potentially behavior problems at risk. And then third, we're working to ensure that Indiana's children have clean water to drink and clean streams and lakes to play in. And there are multiple initiatives at Hoosier Environmental Council that are working both, you know, during the legislative session, but also with programming in the communities to reduce impacts to our waterways, especially of E. coli. So E. coli is a bacterium that comes from feces, and unfortunately, it is the top pollutant in Indiana's waterways. We have several different initiatives to help Indiana move forward with reducing that pollutant.
Jesse, how long has it gone on in this the talks that have led to the merger of improving kids' environment and the Hoosier Environmental Council together on these common goals? How long have you been talking and finally culminated in the merger?
Chris, discussions began in July 2018, and as any responsible organization would do, we wanted to think through this from the standpoint of finances, that this was a sound decision for HEC. We wanted to think about this in terms of strategy. Would we be able to absorb the, elements of the programming of Ike? Would we be able to enhance the relationships, or could it be potentially detrimental to bring these groups together?
Yeah.
So once that due diligence was done, we proceeded ahead.
What has happened now as far as improving kids' environment? Are they pretty much of the HEC within this coalition that's been created, or do some staffers come on board with the HEC on this particular project or separate from it now?
There will not be any staff or board that will be joining HEC. However, I think that the great benefit that I see is that, number one, that as Indra mentioned, there will be a web portal that we'll be inheriting, which is very well regarded in the public health and educator community, given all the work that Ike did to help to mitigate risks from things like pesticides and lead. And so that's a portal that we will continue building upon. And that will be a very important resource going forward for those educators and health professionals. And then the second thing is, once again, just the breadth of contacts that we'll be able to bring on board and engage, particularly from a public policy perspective. Because I think a lot of these folks, educators and health professionals, will probably be getting engaged principally from a programming lens. And I think now my hope is that we can engage them on a legislative lens.
Mm-hmm.
And in the 2020 session, I can think of at least three different pieces of legislation that we anticipate that have real bearing on children's health, including mass transit funding legislation, which, of course, would help to reduce toxic risks from auto exhaust. I can think of this ongoing effort to try to pass legislation related to confined animal feeding operations, which would certainly reduce risk to both air and water in rural areas. And then a third would be related to septic tanks and ways of stepping up inspection of those septic tanks so that they don't pose risks to private drinking water wells.
Jesse and Dr. Frank, are you both feeling that with this merger of the Hoosier Environmental Council and improving kids' environment, that that you have an exciting future? Obviously, you've talked about some of the initiatives that you'd like to see introduced in the General Assembly in the session coming up in about 3 months from now. But do you think that it's going to be an even brighter future for both organizations melted together and working toward this common goal?
I know Indra will have more to say here. But Chris, absolutely. I mean, I think that the scale of the threats facing the environment are significant, and collaboration is such an important theme of Hoosier Environmental Council. It's reflected in Green the State House, which is going to be coming up on November the 16th, where we'll be bringing a few dozen different organizations together. And I think the ultimate in collaboration is of course, a merger. You may recall, Chris, that we had our first merger in 2011 when Legal Environmental Aid Foundation merged into HEC, and that has worked wonderfully.
Mm-hmm.
That led to an enhanced presence of HEC in Northwest Indiana. It also led to us having a in-house legal program, and I think that, as Indra mentioned, bringing on board Ike into HEC will enhance our visibility among those for whom children's health is first and foremost in their mind.
This is a very exciting opportunity. For me, personally, it means an opportunity to return to working on children's environmental health issues like I did when I was serving on the Improving Kids Environment Board.
Going to be a very, very busy early 2020, won't it?
There's always plenty to do.
It certainly sounds that way. I mean, we have two organizations together, well-established over the decades, and the same basic goals of improving the environment, primarily for one, with children in mind, and everybody in general, including children, for the other. Certainly that this next year is going to be a very, very busy one for the expanded Hoosier Environmental Council, including the Improving Kids Environment. Jesse Carbonda is the executive director of the HEC, and Dr. Indra Frank is the environmental health director for the HEC. And thank you both for joining us today and telling us about this interesting merger of these two longtime environmental groups in Indiana and the refocused mission that you all have for youngsters and their health and their welfare. Thank you for being with us today.
Thanks very much, Chris.
And pleasure talking with you.
And we'll have more conversations here about the greening the statehouse as it gets closer here, as established by the Hoosier Environmental Council. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today and for this week. Our thanks to Joe Pete with the Times of Northwest Indiana and Meredith Coleus Pete with the Post Tribune for their contribution, and to Lakeshore Public Radio's Sharon Jackson, and to both Dr. Frank and to Jesse Carbonda with the Hoosier Environmental Council. I'm Chris Nolte. We'll be back with you on Monday.